Bonjour. Nous avons le plaisir d'avoir avec nous aujourd'hui Anne Lecky. Anne Lecky, que nous connaissons en France par sa magnifique trilogie qui s'appelle Les Chroniques du Ratch, Imperial Ratch dans sa version anglaise, qui a été publiée en France aux éditions J'ai lu dans la collection Nouveau Millénaire et qui a été traduit par Patrick Marcel, qui se trouve d'ailleurs ici au premier rang. Anne Lecky, c'est l'occasion de parler, bien entendu, de vos ouvrages, mais aussi de faire connaissance avec vous, et nous nous en réjouissons. Cette trilogie, je rappelle quand même qu'elle est constituée de La justice de l'ancillaire, de L'épée de l'ancillaire, puis la miséricorde de l'ancillaire, dans les titres français. Que le premier a été écrit en 2013 et qu'il a été traduit en France en 2015 et que les suivants sont arrivés très vite en France pour les deux derniers, tous les deux au cours de l'année 2016, le dernier tout récemment. Anne Lecky a provoqué un choc, une réaction, a eu un succès extrêmement rare dès son premier roman, puisqu'elle a accumulé un nombre indécent de prix, depuis le prix Hugo jusqu'au prix Locus du meilleur premier roman, le Nebula, le British SF deux fois, le prix Arthur Clarke, en France le prix Bob Moran, et il y en a plein d'autres que je ne vais pas citer parce que ça pourrait occuper beaucoup trop de temps. Donc, peut-être que nous allons commencer par interroger Anne Lecky, dont il est clair qu'elle a une très grande connaissance de la science-fiction et de ses auteurs, sur la manière dont elle a découvert la science-fiction, à quel âge, dans quelles circonstances. Est-ce que la science-fiction faisait partie de la bibliothèque de vos parents? Est-ce que vous l'avez découvert à quel âge vous avez plongé dans la science-fiction et dans quelles circonstances?
So my parents actually were not science fiction fans. They preferred detective novels, they loved mysteries, and while I was growing up, very often they told me that mysteries could be real literature because they were about human relationships, but science fiction could never be real literature. And as proof of this was the fact that many mystery writers had also written literary things or won literary prizes, but no science fiction writers had. I did not tell them about the many science fiction writers who have also written detective novels. I did not tell them that. So I'm not 100% sure how I got into science fiction, because my parents were telling me these things because I was already a science fiction fan. And thinking about it, I think probably what happened was, when I say my parents, I mean my mother and my stepfather. My stepfather was very much my real dad. He raised me. But there was another parent, a biological parent, who, when I was about 4 years old, this will tell you how old I am, when I was a child, of course, the only way you could see a movie was to go to the theater to see it. You couldn't watch it on your television at home unless it was a special thing that the network was going to show a movie. And so when I was about 4, maybe almost 5, the movie 2001 was coming for a special engagement to be shown in the town where I was growing up. And the parent who had custody of me that weekend wanted to go see 2001, but there was no one to watch me while that happened. And so I ended up at 4 years old in the theater watching 2001 on the big screen. Now, I know plenty of adults who have seen that movie for the first time and have no idea what's going on. So little 4-year-old me, I did not have a chance of understanding anything. But what really stayed with me for a very long time, even when I was very small, was Hal. Especially that scene where Dave is taking out the memory banks and Hal is saying, "I'm afraid," and then he starts to sing "A Bicycle Built for Two." Boy, that stays with you forever, doesn't it? And I suspect it was from that traumatic experience that I was imprinted with science fiction, much to my parents' dismay.
Ah, ça c'est normal, c'est forcément un désespoir. Mais donc, assez vite, vous est venue, je crois, l'envie d'écrire des histoires. Peut-être pas tout de suite des histoires de science-fiction. Alors, j'ai lu un certain nombre d'interviews. Dans l'une d'entre elles, vous allez nous dire si c'est quelque chose de significatif ou pas. J'ai vu que vous aviez eu, dans vos premières envies d'écrire, l'idée d'écrire ce qu'on trouvait dans des magazines, des histoires qui étaient peut-être plus de la romance, en tout cas de la littérature générale. Et est-ce que c'est un projet qui ne vous stimulait pas assez ? Est-ce que vous avez eu envie de le prolonger ou vous êtes passé tout de suite à la science-fiction ?
So yeah, I did want to write from when I was a small child, and my parents encouraged me in this. Actually, they felt that I was talented, and they encouraged me to write. What I wanted was to get money for my writing. That would mean I was a professional writer. And where I lived, there were no science fiction magazines. I would go into the drugstore, and there would be lots of magazines, but none of them were science fiction magazines. So even though I wanted to write science fiction, I did not think that I could get money for writing science fiction, or I didn't know how. But I knew from my parents telling me that I could look in the front of any magazine and find the submission guidelines and the address for where to send submissions. So at the time, there was a line of magazines in the U.S. They had titles like True Confessions and True Romance and True Love and True Stories, and they were all romance stories. And they were all meant to be sort of shocking, but not so shocking that anything really horrible would actually happen. Usually the way these stories would go would be, we would say something terrible was about to happen, but then it would turn out to be everything was okay, right? And then they would kiss at the end and it would be great. And it's not my favorite kind of story. Obviously, a lot of people love these stories, which is cool, but I wasn't one of them. But so what I did was I said, I want money for my writing, and I'm willing to write anything if someone will give me money for it. So I went to the store, and I bought a big stack of these magazines, and I read them, and I read them, and I read them until I knew what kind of story they wanted. And then I sat down to the typewriter. This is how long ago that was. It was actually a typewriter. It was my mother's old portable Olivetti. And I wrote a story that was going to be like all the stories that I had read, and I sent it in, and they bought it. They actually paid me money for this. And so I said, oh, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can be a writer. And then I thought, so all I need to do is write another story like that. And I thought, I didn't like writing that story. I didn't like reading the stories that helped me write the story. I don't like this kind of story. It's not my kind of thing. And so I said, you know what? It's not worth going through all that and then not enjoying it. And that was actually a very important lesson for me, because later on in life, and it still happens now, I would be presented with a story, even inside fantasy and science fiction, that isn't making me happy to write, that I'm not enjoying, but maybe someone will give me money for it. And the question is it worth it to me to put out a story I'm not proud of and I don't love, even if I get money for it? What's more valuable there, that I'm happy with what I've done or that I've gotten a little bit of money? And for me, everybody's going to make their own decision about that. There isn't a right or a wrong way to answer that question, but for me, I discovered very early on that it was important to me that I be very proud of the work that I was doing and that the money was less important to me.
Et donc, pendant les années qui ont suivi, à partir de 2005 à peu près, vous avez commencé à publier régulièrement des nouvelles de science-fiction. Est-ce que vous avez trouvé cette satisfaction que vous espériez dans l'écriture de la nouvelle, ou est-ce que dès le départ, vous avez eu le projet de vous lancer dans un roman en considérant que c'était plus ambitieux, plus satisfaisant ? En France, en tout cas, on parle beaucoup de la difficulté d'avoir des débouchés pour les nouvelles. Qu'est-ce qui vous a motivé dans le passage à un projet plus ambitieux?
I actually started out writing a novel. The very first serious science fiction and fantasy project was a novel, and in fact it was in the Rauch universe. I had already had the idea for Ancillary Justice, but I was afraid of it. It was too difficult and intimidating. So I sort of wrote a story around the edges. And when I was done, I actually submitted it to some places, and of course it was rejected because it is dreadful. Believe me, it is really an awful novel. And now I'm very glad that nobody bought it. And so having done that, I said, you know, it takes a long time to write a novel, and it takes a long time to submit. Sometimes you submit a novel someplace, and it will be in their mailbox for a year or more. But short stories, it's a much shorter time to write one. And there are a number of places. By then I had found what the names of some of the magazines were, and the more I looked, the more magazines I found. And they'll send you your story back with a rejection in a month or two, which is much easier. And at least in the U.S., historically, in science fiction, the sort of expected path was that you would write short stories first and sell those and learn your skills that way and build up a reputation, and then you would sell a novel, having worked your way up to the novel. That's not actually the way it works all the time, but that's the narrative of how it's supposed to happen. So I said, well, I'll put the novel aside and I will focus on the short stories. And so I did that for several years, and it took me a while to learn to write shorter. That was very difficult because I was used to having all this space to spread out and put in all the cool stuff in short stories. You have to make them very very targeted, very aimed. Nothing is in the short story except what contributes to the ending of the short story so that you can fit it in that very small space. And that was very difficult. And eventually, I worked my way down to a story of 300 words, which I sold. I was very proud of myself. That was as short as I ever went. And then I said, all right, I've done that, so now I'm going to go back to the novel, because if I don't write it, I'm never going to write it. And so I set the short stories aside, and I went back to the novels.
300 mots, ça fait à peu près une page, hein, pour donner un ordre de grandeur. Donc c'est vraiment un texte très court. Et là, je suis désolée, je vais vous reposer une question qui vous a déjà été posée dans d'autres contextes, mais tout le monde n'a peut-être pas entendu ce qui a été le déclencheur. Vous aviez un projet, en tout cas une envie de récit qui était assez claire. Vous aviez des réflexions sur la question du genre et de son omniprésence dans nos cultures que vous aviez envie de traiter. Et apparemment, c'était un projet très difficile, très ambitieux. Et à ce moment-là, l'opportunité d'un concours qui s'appelle le Nanovrimo, je dois très mal le prononcer, mais écriture sur une durée d'un mois avec une quantité obligatoire de signes à produire tous les jours a été un élément déclencheur. Alors est-ce que vous voulez bien nous en parler un petit peu puisque ça a été déterminant pour vous?
It was very, very important. And I was talking to someone the other day, and he said, oh, you mean it's like Inktober, which is you spend the month of October and do a drawing every day if you're a visual artist. I said, it's a lot like Inktober. Yeah, I had wanted to write seriously, but I always said to myself, well, I must not be talented, because when I sit down to write, the words don't just come. It's hard. I don't know where to start. I have a little voice in the back of my head telling me I can't do it. And obviously, the writers who are my heroes, they don't have an experience like this. They just sit down and write this genius stuff that I love so much. And so that was always keeping me from really trying. And so some friends of mine one year said, do you know about NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month? And in fact, it starts tomorrow. So the idea of NaNoWriMo is just to write. It does not have to be good. Nobody else has to read it. It just has to be 50,000 words. And that comes out to about 1,667 words a day, every single day. And the only way to do that is to just sort of type and just keep writing no matter what, just whatever comes into your head. And the result is not very good. It can't be, unless there are some people who write that fast, but I'm not one of them. But in the end, you have this great big project that you did that seemed so scary at the beginning, but by breaking it down into just 2,000 words a day, it's like 2,000, that's doable. That's a couple of pages. That's not bad. when you think, oh, 100,000 words, I can't do that. But when you say 1,000 words a day, that's, you can do that. And for me, it was really important to learn that that little voice in the back of my head that told me that what I was writing was stupid and worthless, it was all talk. It was all talk and no bite. It would talk and talk and talk, and if I kept writing anyway, it didn't matter. It couldn't do anything to me. And in the end, my friends looked at it and said, oh, this is kind of good. We like this. And I also learned what it felt like to sit down and say, now I am going to write, and then write, which it sounds odd to say that that's a difficult thing to understand how to do, but that's one of the hardest things to understand when you're a new writer, is just where to start and how to begin. And so NaNoWriMo helped me get a habit of feeling what it felt like to sit down to write. And so sometimes I hear people say, oh, NaNoWriMo, it's just a bunch of people writing horrible stuff, and it doesn't do anybody any good, and let the real writers write. Well, as far as I'm concerned, if you write, you're a writer. And I think there's a lot to be learned. And I think even if you don't, even if you're not aiming to be published, there's something valuable in feeling like you can sit down and create something and bring this thing out of your mind onto the page. And so I love NaNoWriMo. And so for folks who are beginning writers who are having trouble getting over that anxiety, I always recommend it to just write. And there are message boards, and you go on and say, oh, I wrote 500 words today. And then the people on the message board go, yay, you're wonderful, go you. And then you can return the favor. They can say, oh, I wrote some words. And you can go, yay, you're wonderful. And it just helps so much to feel like there are other people with you, encouraging you. So I love NaNoWriMo, and it was very deciding for me. Because when I was done, I said to myself, oh, maybe I can do this.
On va venir évidemment sur l'Empire Ratchaï, l'ancillaire et tout ce qu'il y a de fascinant dans le roman. Mais j'ai encore une ou deux questions que j'aimerais bien vous poser pour qu'on continue à faire connaissance avec vous. Et moi, je me suis demandé, c'était votre premier roman, et ça a dû être complètement étourdissant d'avoir une telle réception de son tout premier roman, d'être salué par tous les prix majeurs. C'est extrêmement intimidant. Et je serais curieuse de savoir... comment vous l'avez vécu? Est-ce que ça a été un stimulant ou est-ce que ça vous a mis sur les épaules une pression terrible?
It was really interesting. At the beginning of the year, it was published, and then they have what we call in science fiction award season. It starts about in January when some of the awards start coming out. And round about the beginning of award season, there's a tiny little award that's based in the UK called the Kitschies. And the Kitschies give out the Tentacle Awards. And so there's the Golden Tentacle for Best First Novel. And the trophy for this is a hand-sewn, stuffed, satin, golden, like a squiggly tentacle. One of the people who runs the awards sews it herself with these sparkly little pom-poms glued onto it for suckers. And then they've taken a marker and written the name of the book on the thing. And so my book was nominated for the Kitschies Golden Tentacle. And I was so happy and excited. I said, this is wonderful. My book is nominated for an award. And then it won the Golden Tentacle. And I was so proud of it. And it came, I couldn't be there. My editor sent it to me in the mail. And I put it up on my mantle. And I was like, look at this, I won an award. And I figured that was it, right? I was like, that's my award that I won for my book. That's just the best thing ever. And then the other ones started to roll in. And I started to feel like I was hallucinating. I was pretty sure that at some point I was going to wake up in the hospital and the doctor was going to say to me, Anne, you were in a terrible car accident. You've been in a coma for the last year. Nothing that you think happened happened, right? Your family's been very worried, but there are no trophies. By the end of the year, I was just like, this can't really be happening, because when you're like a little baby science fiction writer, of course you dream about the Hugo and the Nebula. They end up on the book cover, Hugo Award winning. And you sort of fantasize about it secretly, like in the bathroom when nobody's looking. And then before you come out of the room, you say, okay, that's done. That's never going to happen, right? And then it really actually happened. And I still have trouble. Sometimes I still look over at the shelf and kind of laugh and have trouble believing it's all still there. But I have to tell you that really the Golden Tentacle is still kind of my favorite because it was the first one.
Et on va peut-être, on reviendra sur la manière dont vous avez vécu les choses. Mais je crois qu'il faut qu'on commence à parler du projet que vous avez eu. Et c'est un ouvrage magistral et florissant. Et il a tellement d'aspects dont on peut discuter qu'on va les prendre dans n'importe quel ordre et en vrac, si vous êtes d'accord. On peut peut-être commencer par le principe même de l'Empire Ratch que vous décrivez. Et... Je ne l'ai pas dit en début de présentation, mais moi, comme je n'avais accès qu'à la version française de vos ouvrages, qui était magnifique, mais que je prévoyais que la discussion pourrait être compliquée par le fait que ce que j'avais lu n'était pas tout à fait ce que vous aviez écrit, un très bon lecteur qui ne vous lit qu'en anglais, mais qui est français, Pascal Thomas, m'a aidé à préparer les questions. Et parmi les premiers points sur lesquels il a attiré mon attention, il m'a dit c'est vrai que l'Empire Ratchaï ressemble d'une manière assez frappante à l'Empire romain par tout un tas de termes, de concepts. Alors, on parle du statut de citoyen qui est accordé aux peuples qui sont conquis. On parle de clientélisme entre familles nobles. Il y a les religions locales qui sont absorbées au lieu d'être remplacées, donc qui s'intègrent dans la religion sans créer trop de perturbations. Il y a un empereur, un peu particulier cet empereur. Mais... Alors, d'où vient votre intérêt pour cet empire romain ? Il y a eu dans les civilisations humaines d'autres civilisations conquérantes qui ont laissé leur marque. Est-ce que vous avez un intérêt particulier pour celle-ci ? Est-ce que vous l'aviez beaucoup étudiée ?
I do a fair amount as a hobbyist. I'm not a specialist. When I was younger, I used to find the Romans not very interesting, and I thought the Greeks were really cool, but the Romans were kind of dry and boring. But the more I looked at Roman civilization, the more interested I became in the way they thought about religion, the way they thought about citizenship. And the more I realized something that I guess can be hard to see, that we are still strongly influenced by the Romans today in Europe and in the United States, because so many of us in the United States are European. It's amazing how, in a lot of ways, we're still processing the results of Roman imperialism. We're still dealing with the impact of Rome's culture. And on top of that, for science fictional purposes, Rome is a really good model for a large-scale empire with a lot of time lag, with a lot of historical drama. And so you can look at Rome and pick out things that would make good stories that will also fit really well in a science fictional context. And so when I'm looking for a model for my space empire, it seems natural to go look at Rome. So I did take a lot of things in particular from Roman civilization, not necessarily from Roman history, although Rome did break apart and come back together and then break apart, and part of it wasn't Rome anymore. But it lasted for a very, very long time. And so there's a lot of history to choose from. A lot of science fiction, we talk about it as though it's talking about the future, but history is actually a really useful place for people to look for material to use for talking about the future, and a lot of authors do that. And Rome offers a lot of material.
Mais vous n'avez pas utilisé que les Romains comme matériaux, et puis vous avez inventé aussi beaucoup de traces culturelles spécifiques. Et une de celles que j'ai trouvées les plus fascinantes, et je me suis demandé d'où l'idée avait pu vous venir, d'avoir autour de la cérémonie du thé, qui est très présente et apparemment très significative comme marque d'une culture sophistiquée et raffinée, il y a aussi le fait que dans certaines circonstances, il est indécent de montrer ses mains nues. Il faut porter des gants dans certaines circonstances. Et effectivement, c'était intéressant de peut-être de d'évoquer la pudeur et vous ne pouviez pas le faire sous l'angle de la question du sexe puisque justement il n'en était pas question. Alors les gants, c'est venu comment? Qu'est-ce qui vous a fait tourner autour de cette idée? Est-ce que c'est lié au thé ou est-ce que c'est deux choses complètement distinctes?
They're two distinct things, although the gloves are partly because sometimes when you're reading about different cultures, you realize that our ideas about what's decent or indecent have a lot more to do with culture than they do about with any kind of inherent morality. So you get, you know, a couple hundred years ago, you were supposed to cover your ankles all the time. Well, you know, half of us are walking around here with knee-length skirts and, you know, our ankles are flashing all over the place, but we don't think of that as provocative or sexy or anything. That's just how you walk around during the day. There are lots of cultures where they're less covered up than we consider decent or more covered up and think we're walking around indecent. So the gloves were just a way to kind of play with that. And as you say, I didn't necessarily want to write a bunch of sexy stuff, but I could sort of use those kind of issues to communicate things by saying, oh, well, bare hands, that's sexy and indecent, right? The tea I used for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons, I have to admit, is because I love tea. And so anytime you can write about something you know a lot about, that's helpful because you don't have to look things up. And when you know about something, it always goes down on the page more clearly than when you're writing about something you don't know a lot about. Also, I am a tremendous fan of C.J. Cherry, in particular her Foreigner series. And in Foreigner, the aliens, the Atevi, drink a lot of tea. And tea is very socially important. So whenever there's an important meeting or you're going to have a big conversation, there's always going to be tea involved. Once I had decided to use tea, partly as a hat tip to C.J. Cherry, who I admire so much, and partly because I like tea, then it became a prop available to use so that I could use the tea and handling the tea to express things that it was difficult just to say straightforward. So if there's a very tense conversation, I can kind of convey some of the way people are feeling by the way that they're handling the tea, which they're drinking a lot of. And so that became very useful for me to be able to do that.
Alors, nous n'avons pas encore parlé de l'aspect le plus fréquemment évoqué à propos de ce roman, qui est sa manière extraordinaire de prendre le parti de gommer la question du genre ou la question du sexe en imaginant une civilisation pour laquelle elle n'est pas significative. C'est une question qu'on ne se pose pas quand on rencontre des gens, c'est pas important ou c'est privé, mais on rencontre des gens. Et l'écriture a été construite, puis reconstruite en français avec nécessairement des systèmes légèrement différents, puisque la langue est différente, de manière à ce qu'on ne connaisse pas le sexe des individus qui sont présents. Et vous avez choisi le parti pris extraordinaire et très surprenant, on n'y est pas habitué en tout cas, de ne parler des personnages que au féminin, le neutre et le féminin. Et je pense que nous, en tant que lecteurs, nous recevons tous cela d'une manière différente. Je m'en suis aperçue en discutant avec des gens qui avaient trouvé autant de plaisir que moi à vous lire, mais moi, j'ai eu l'impression que votre livre était peuplé de femmes, et ça m'a fait bizarre au début, et au bout d'un certain temps, ça ne m'a plus du tout gênée. Mais j'avais besoin de faire un effort conscient pour me dire, non, c'est pas forcément que des femmes, mais vous écriviez de manière à ce que moi je voyais des femmes. Et je me suis aperçue qu'autour de moi, il y avait des gens qui avaient lu le même livre et qui avaient cherché des indices, alors dans le texte anglais ou dans le texte français, et ce n'était pas toujours les mêmes, disant « Ah, mais tel personnage est sûrement un homme. Ah, à un moment donné, quelqu'un qui n'est pas de la culture Ratchaï le désigne sous une forme masculine. Ou bien on découvre qu'il a une barbe, donc c'est peut-être un homme. Ou bien on s'agenouille devant lui, ah là, on ne sait pas. Mais est-ce que dans votre tête, vous avez réussi à gommer complètement la question du genre, c'est-à-dire que pour vous, ce sont juste des personnes, ou est-ce que quelque part, vous les imaginez quand même un petit peu hommes ou femmes, puisqu'ils le sont de toute façon, c'est juste que socialement, ça n'est pas évoqué dans cette culture.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's very interesting to me to see the different ways people have read that. Some readers have indeed read the entire book and thought to themselves, oh, this is just a book all full of women, and didn't realize until later talking to other readers that actually that's not necessarily what was going on. I don't mind it when people read it like that. It's perfectly fine to me. I found the process of writing that actually very interesting because I began the very first part of the first draft of Ancillary Justice. I was assigning binary genders to the characters and calling them he and she. And I did not like the results of that because that was not giving the impression of a culture that genuinely found gender irrelevant, which is what I wanted. So after thinking about a number of different things, I actually wrote a short story in that universe calling everyone he, just explaining that it didn't really mean he, but it wasn't getting across the effect that I wanted. It read like a 50s science fiction story, right? I mean, they're already like that. There's just nothing but guys in them. And so then I said, well, what if I do she? And so it meant for those first chapters that I had to just write she for everyone who I had already written he for. And what was really interesting to me was that although the characters had not changed at all, I did not change anything else about those characters, the way that I envisioned them changed. They became much more ambiguously gendered to me rather than, oh, this character is a guy. Now that character seemed like I wasn't sure, like they were sort of androgynous, or maybe suddenly that character seemed feminine to me. And I thought that was really interesting, how powerful words are. Just those little pronouns have that large of an effect on how you see someone. And so it's so very important. But we don't think about it. They're just words that come out of our mouth every day. And I realized that was part of why I wasn't happy with using he and she, that using he and she, I could never get the effect of a culture that didn't care about gender. Genuinely, it was irrelevant because the he was always going to force a particular, for me, not necessarily for them, for me, he was going to force a particular set of assumptions about what a person was like. And if I used she, it was going to force a particular set of assumptions about what that person was like. And it's been interesting to me also, every now and then, a reader will say to me, I had trouble envisioning the characters because I did not have the right gender pronoun for them. And I find that very interesting because what that says to me is that, and this includes me, I'm not trying to be self-righteous and say I am enlightened and all these readers are not. It's not at all. I'm saying this happens to me too, that when I hear she about a character, often I won't ask for any more description because I'll feel like that will have told me a lot about the person. But it tells us nothing about the person, really, if you think about it. And so for me, it was very much a learning experience. It was very interesting and very disorienting. And at first I thought it would be too disorienting for a novel that I wanted other people to read. But the more that I did it, the more that I liked it, and the more that I thought about the effect. And so I'm really glad that I stuck with that.
Alors, vous pulvérisez complètement le regard qu'on a habituellement sur des gens. Vous le pulvérisez avec cette question-là, puisqu'effectivement, c'est la première chose qu'on regarde d'habitude. Est-ce que j'ai un homme ou une femme en face de moi ? On est obligé d'oublier ça. Mais vous faites bien pire, puisque votre narrateur, le personnage principal, Breck, est quand même un être troublant sur de multiples aspects. Alors d'abord, pour commencer, c'est une intelligence artificielle dans un corps humain dont on a gommé la trace, la mémoire, l'identité. On parlera de l'aspect vaisseau et collectif après, si vous voulez bien. Mais moi, déjà, je me dis, vous imaginez une IA dans un corps humain. Et c'est déjà un parti pris très troublant. Est-ce que vous prenez le parti pris de vous dire, on peut gommer la personnalité, il ne reste rien dans le corps. Qu'est-ce qui reste comme empreinte humaine de votre point de vue? Parce que l'ambiguïté, ce personnage Breck est fascinant, mais toutes les questions ne sont pas levées à son sujet. Alors qu'est-ce qui reste de l'humanité antérieure portée par le corps au-delà de son intelligence artificielle?
That's a really good question. A lot of times I find readers will assume that Breck has no memory whatsoever of the identity that was in that body. And that's actually not the case. One of the things when I was doing research for this book, when I said, okay, this is what I want, how would that work? And so I had to do some reading about human neurology and how identity works. And it turns out, this is kind of scary and creepy, our sense of identity has a lot to do with the way our brains are constructed. And if you have the right brain damage, you will believe that you are dead, or that you do not exist, or that you are outside of your body. And it's just a question of, very often it's strokes that will do it. It's not like something will fall and hit your head and you'll believe you're dead. That's not going to happen. But if you cut the right connections in your brain, you don't believe you are who you are. One of the more disturbing ones that often happens to what's called split brain patients, which I guess I'll need to explain that what that is in a minute, is what's called alien hand syndrome. I don't know what it's called in French. And what happens there is somebody's, usually their left hand, will just start doing things, and you'll say, you know, stop picking up the water bottle, but you can't make it stop. Your hand is going to do whatever it's going to do. And in some cases, somebody will become convinced that their arm is not theirs, right? In one case I read about, the doctor said to the person, that's your arm, and the person says, no, it's not my arm. And the doctor said, well, if it's not yours, whose is it? And the person would say, like, oh, it must be yours, because it isn't mine. But, I mean, it's obviously their arm. And obviously something in their brain changed that makes them feel that that part of their body is not part of them. So I said to myself, if you can do that to a human brain, then it must be possible to go in and surgically do that and say, you're not you anymore, now you're part of me, right? That arm, it's not your arm, it's my arm. And then just introduce communication so that you're always telling that body what to do. So those ancillaries, the prisoners of war that are taken and slaved to the ship in this way, they do still have their memories. In theory, the person they were is still there, but that person is dead. That person has been, the conviction that they are that person has been erased. Split brain patients, just to explain, for those of you who haven't heard of this, some people with really terrible epilepsy, the seizures are so bad that they're in danger of killing them. And very often, the only way to mitigate them is to cut the connection between the two hemispheres of the brain, the corpus callosum. And this saves lives when they do this. But what it means is there's very little communication between the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. And you can get some very strange effects when you say something into one ear and then ask the other ear what it was that was just said. Or you show something to one eye, and then on the other side ask the ear, what did you see? And the effect is very much as though you're talking to two different people in one body, which is very creepy and disturbing. But of course, the people don't experience themselves as being more than one person. But it really raised the question in my mind, what is identity? What does it mean when I say, I am me? Maybe that's meaningless. Maybe that's an artifact of my brain convincing me that I'm one person, but really I'm a bunch of different systems that if I didn't have that, they wouldn't work together.
Et la question de l'identité, vous la pulvérisez encore d'une autre manière, toujours avec le même personnage, puisque l'identité, la personnalité dont il est question au départ, c'est celle du vaisseau Justice of Torren, et que c'est une entité collective qui s'incarne dans plusieurs centaines d'ancillaires, et que l'individu dont nous faisons la connaissance est le dernier survivant de cette entité collective, et on le ressent par tous les regrets qu'éprouve ce fragment unique et isolé de la période où il avait plusieurs corps, où il occupait plusieurs lieux en même temps, où il ressentait simultanément tout ce qui se produisait à plusieurs endroits. Et comment vous imaginez la chose? Comment est-ce qu'une expérience qui est partagée entre plusieurs centaines de cerveaux, qu'est-ce qu'il peut en rester quand il n'en reste qu'un? Est-ce qu'il y a assez de place pour tout enregistrer dans un seul cerveau?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I don't think there can be. I think that Breck's memories must be somewhat incomplete. She has to remember being the kind of being she used to be, but I don't think she can possibly remember everything, and that's part of her struggle, is that information that she would have had access to is gone, and it's permanently gone. There are memories that are gone. She probably remembers a lot. I think the ancillaries are upgraded, augmented. That's the word I'm looking for. They're augmented with various implants to let them process more information, to make them stronger and faster. So she can remember a lot. But in the end, she can't actually contain everything that she used to be. It would be like, you know, if all that was left of you was your hand. It couldn't remember everything. It couldn't be everything. But she can remember when she was all of herself. And that's really upsetting to her, because she knows she can never, ever, ever be that again.
Et il y a encore un autre personnage qui est fascinant, toujours autour de ce jeu entre le collectif et l'individuel. C'est le... l'empereur ou l'impératrice Anand Dharmyanai, qui dirige l'empire Rajshahi depuis 3000 ans, en s'incarnant dans de multiples corps tous identiques, qui existent à des âges différents, sur des tas de lieux, et qui communiquent entre eux. Et avec tout ce vertige et toute cette réflexion que vous nous obligez à avoir, je me suis dit, il y a au moins un autre auteur qui travaille sur la question de l'identité d'une autre manière que vous, mais qui en fait la question centrale. Qu'est-ce que c'est qu'être je? Qu'est-ce que c'est que l'identité? C'est Greg Egan. Avez-vous vu Greg Egan? Avez-vous lu Greg Egan? Parce que le voir, c'est autre chose. Et est-ce que ce qu'il écrit vous intéresse? Vous semble avoir est-ce que vous vous sentez en familiarité avec ces questionnements?
I know of Greg Egan. I have never read his work. I've never met him. I have been very interested to read his work, actually, since I don't know what he's been doing. I gather he does, his understanding of physics is really, really good. He writes a very good hard SF. And so I've been super interested too. But rather ironically, I got into this partly because I love to read so much, and that's part of why I wanted to write. Now that I've been successful in writing, I have very little time to read fiction. So now I have a big, big, big stack of things I really want to read and very little time to read them.
Alors, il y a un aspect dont on n'a pas parlé non plus. C'est le fait qu'il y a énormément d'humour dans votre roman. On sent que vous êtes chaleureuse et vivante. L'image de la personne que vous avez en face de vous, moi, c'est ce que j'ai ressenti à la lecture de l'ouvrage. Ça fait d'ailleurs grand plaisir quand le bonheur qui émane d'un ouvrage, on le retrouve quand on est en face de la personne qui l'a écrit. Vous êtes en cohérence avec ce que vous écrivez. Et il y a un des aspects les plus drôles de votre ouvrage, pour moi, qui m'a beaucoup fait rire, ce sont... Les interprètes Press Girls, parce que maintenant je sais qu'il ne faut pas dire les traducteurs grâce à Patrick Marcel, qui sont donc les ambassadeurs d'une race extra-humaine extrêmement différente de l'humanité, qui ont été construits, incarnés dans des corps humains pour établir la discussion avec les humains, mais qui sont quand même tellement pas humains sous leur apparence que les discussions avec eux sont totalement surréalistes. Que, par exemple, ils ne savent pas trop qui ils sont, qui ils sont, qui sont-ils. Ils hésitent entre plusieurs noms, plusieurs étiquettes. Là, vous la pulvérisez complètement, la notion d'identité. Et ils parlent d'une manière complètement décalée, alors là, qui correspond à aucune culture humaine. Et c'est surréaliste et incroyablement drôle. Comment est-ce que vous avez fait pour inventer ces ambassadeurs extraordinaires? Est-ce que vous avez ri en les faisant parler? Parce qu'on rit en vous lisant.
I absolutely laughed when I was writing the translators. There are some of my favorite characters. There's two of them that appear in the books. And actually, the first one who appears, translated Like, she arrives and... I had so much fun writing that conversation between her and Breck because she's completely off the wall. She doesn't have any sense of who she is. She doesn't really understand what's right. she talks about her past in ways that are completely bizarre, and but she looks quite human, but she's obviously, the way she talks, she can't possibly be. And she was so much fun, but I could only keep her, I don't want to be a spoiler, I could only keep her on stage for one chapter. And when it was obvious to me that I wasn't going to get any more fun out of this character, I was very, very sad. And in fact, sometimes I see readers tweet, they'll tweet saying, oh, I just ran into translated Like in the book, and she's wonderful, she's my favorite character, I'm laughing so hard, I'm going to enjoy the rest of this book. And then I just wait about an hour till they get to the end of the chapter, and then they're sometimes kind of angry with me, and I can't blame them, because I was angry with myself. I tried to make her stay longer, but I couldn't do it. And so when the third book came around, I said, I'm going to get as much fun out of this other translator as I possibly can. And of course, that translator arrives and introduces herself as translated Like. And Breck says, no, you're not translated Like. You're a different translator. And they proceed to have this conversation. But she was as funny as I could make her on purpose, because just writing the bizarre things that she says and the way everyone reacts to her was just a tremendous amount of fun.
Et vous êtes en train de continuer à écrire dans cet univers, il est loin d'être épuisé. Je crois que vous avez déjà en projet une suite, un quatrième volume. Est-ce que c'est, on peut l'espérer, ou il y aura de toute façon au moins des nouvelles dans l'univers Ratchai?
The universe that I began to construct is a really large one. It's already very large. And what that means is, first off, I've put a lot of work into it, so I don't want to just lay it aside. And it's also so large that I can tell a lot of different stories with it. So I plan to stay in that universe for a while. The next book, which I'm working on, will be in that universe, but it is not with the same characters, and it's not in Raj space, so it's very far away from the Raj. But it is in the same universe, and it does connect up one way or another with the events of the trilogy.
Alors, il y a un aspect dont on n'a pas beaucoup parlé. Il nous faudrait 3 heures. Hein. Moi, je serais ravie qu'on ait 3 heures, mais on joue beaucoup sur les rencontres des cultures, sur la manière dont une culture en assimile une autre, dont elle se marie, dont une culture donne une place à une autre et accepte de la reconnaître. Et si j'ai bien lu votre biographie, il me semble que vous vivez à Saint-Louis, dans le Missouri, que vous y êtes né. Je ne sais pas si vous avez beaucoup voyagé par le passé, mais une chose me semble claire avec le succès que vous avez obtenu, c'est qu'actuellement, au moins, vous devez beaucoup voyager. Donc, la question que j'aimerais vous poser, c'est fascinant dans votre ouvrage de voir justement comment des cultures différentes cohabitent. Si vous voyagez beaucoup maintenant, quelle est l'impression que vous retirez de vos voyages? Est-ce qu'il y a une uniformisation qui fait que finalement tout le monde a à peu près les mêmes codes vestimentaires, les mêmes modes d'expression et les mêmes règles de communication? Ou est-ce que le monde est plein de cultures variées, différentes, entre lesquelles la rencontre est encore à construire?
I think it's sort of in between the two, because everywhere I've traveled, every place is very different, and the people who live there have their own sort of way of being, a different speed of walking, a different way of moving, a different, even if it's a very small difference, but you can kind of feel when you're in a different place. And of course, when you go to different countries, that difference is even greater. But at the same time, there are a lot of similarities. Most of the places that I've gone, most people wear more or less the same kinds of clothes. And eat sort of the same kinds of foods, but the way they eat them or whether they have them for breakfast or for dinner. I remember being, this is kind of silly, I consider myself a very adventurous eater, but the first time I visited Scandinavia, I was in Oslo and in the hotel and came downstairs for breakfast, and I was very sort of shocked and surprised at how different breakfast is in Scandinavia than it is in the U.S. And of course, it wasn't a problem. I get used to it. I will, you know, eat what's essentially a sandwich for breakfast. It doesn't bother me. But it really just sort of stopped me. I was like, what? Is this breakfast? And so It's not a big difference, but there are differences everywhere. And I think if you want to say everyone's the same and everything's becoming homogenous, you can find evidence for that, because there is a lot of communication and a lot of travel and a lot of ideas spread, and sometimes cultures impose their ideas on other ones. But at the same time, if you want to say, no, actually, people are different in different places, you can find a lot of evidence for that too, because in fact, people are different. Anytime you have a group of people living together and talking together, they're going to sort of develop their own way of speaking and their own way of living.
Dans la communauté des auteurs de science-fiction, je vais essayer de garder 5 minutes pour que vous aussi vous puissiez poser des questions, donc je me dépêche de glisser la mienne. Je sais que vous avez pris au moins pendant une période des responsabilités collectives. Vous avez été secrétaire de la SFWA, je crois, entre 2012 et 2013. Est-ce que pour vous la science-fiction est vraiment quelque chose de collectif? Est-ce que vous avez l'impression qu'il est nécessaire qu'il y ait des porte-paroles, des lieux, une communauté, ou est-ce que vous le percevez comme quelque chose qui est une trajectoire personnelle? On est toujours entre l'individu et le collectif, et j'aimerais bien savoir vous comment vous le ressentez dans votre vie d'auteur de science-fiction.
So again, I think both are important and both are valuable. Each of us is an individual, and every writer will have their own things that they value. They'll have their own particular history. They'll have their own particular things that they're trying to do, and that's important and needs to be supported. I absolutely argue with anyone who says, oh, you have to write this one particular way, or you have this one particular career path that's the good one. The one that works for you is the good one. But at the same time, all of us are writers, writing, many of us dealing with the same publishers and the same editors over and over again. And it's important that people be able to communicate with each other about problems, for instance, support each other when there are difficulties, when one particular person needs help, financial help or help with health care, or it's important to have a group of folks you can go and say, I need this help, and the group can provide that help. So I think that collective action is extremely important, and being able to have the people to communicate with and the people who can help you negotiate in situations where there's an argument with a publisher or an editor, just like at work, you want to be able to negotiate with the boss. You don't want the boss to just treat you unfairly. You want to be able to say, no, we're going to stand together. Now, we can't, for legal reasons in the U.S., we can't ever have a union of science fiction writers. But the closest we can have is all of us getting together and communicating and contributing to try and help each other when we need that help. And I consider that to be very important. And that was one of the reasons when a friend of mine wanted to run for the board of the SFWA and came to me and said, would you run for secretary? And I said, I think it's important to contribute to this. And so not just by paying my dues, that was part of my way of contributing to that.
Bon, je pense que vous aussi vous brûlez de questions à poser à Anne Leki. Elle est ici. Il nous reste quelques minutes, donc voilà. Si des questions vous démangent,
Hi.
Il faut toujours un petit moment pour se lancer. Sinon, moi j'en ai encore une quantité, donc.
Sorry, I have a question about 1ESC19. Personally, I think I really kind of fell in love with Lieutenant On when she went to see the birth of the new 1ESC19. And I wanted to know if would the story would have been different if it wasn't this specific ancillary that survived the destruction of Justice of Doran, and the fact that it's this specific body with this specific experience that survived and became Brick.
That's a really good question, and I think the answer is that yes, the story would have been different. All of 1Esk, all 20 bodies of 1Esk, were of course deeply in love with Lieutenant On. But 1Esk 19 had that very special experience at the beginning, which was a horrifying experience for the person who was being slaved to the ship. But Lieutenant On was there to comfort that segment of her own ancillary unit, and that was an unusual thing. And so, and plus, I think that particular, whoever that person was before she was made into an ancillary, the person that she was made a difference. And so I do think that it's entirely possible that if a different ancillary had survived, that the ancillary would have chosen to go off and do something else. I also think sometimes, like I didn't write it, like, you know, I didn't do it on purpose, that 1Esk-19 was not the closest to the shuttle. And Justice of Torin might well have chosen that particular ancillary knowing that 19 was going to keep going no matter what.
Bon, j'en profite pour glisser une question. Je pense que vous avez dû probablement susciter un petit peu de grogne auprès de la communauté des Rabbit Puppies ou quelques autres. Puisque vous avez quand même un certain nombre de principes qui peut-être n'ont pas plu à tout le monde, comme par exemple le fait que dans la société Ratchai, plus on a la peau foncée, plus on est haut d'un point de vue de l'aristocratie. Alors, est-ce que vous avez fait de la provocation ou ça s'est trouvé comme ça, simplement ?
It was just the way it happened, quite honestly. I was trying not to make my civilization be what so often, especially in past decades, future science fiction societies tended to be, whatever you're used to today, transported into the future with some funny names and shiny clothes, right? And I didn't want that. I felt like if you're going to look at the future, more than just the clothes you wear and the machines that you have are going to change. In fact, if those things change, so many other things are going to. So I wanted to avoid that. So I said, instead of making it just a replica of what I see around me, I'm going to very deliberately change some things. The fact that certain people were provoked is, in my opinion, kind of on them. And to some extent, I feel like, you know, you're known by the quality of your enemies. So it really doesn't bother me very much. You know, they get to like whatever books they like and dislike whatever they like. I don't have a problem with people who don't like my books. There are books that I don't like, and that's a perfectly fine thing to do. So, you know, mostly I just don't worry about it.
Écoutez, nous arrivons au bout d'un temps qu'on aurait aimé prolonger, mais qui a été formidable. Donc, un grand merci à Anne Leckie pour ses livres et pour ses explications. Et voilà.
Thank you very much.
Vous allez retrouver Anne dans la librairie. Elle va dédicacer, je crois, pendant l'heure qui vient. Donc, n'hésitez pas à aller la voir. Et merci à tous.